This is London Calling.
Happy New Year, I'm Graham Mack, welcome to the programme and 2018. But who was the best guest on this show in 2017? I spoke to some amazing people. Will it be Glenn Matlock from the Sex Pistols? Slim Jim Phantom from the Stray Cats? Will it be Dominic Monaghan from Lord of the Rings and Lost? Or Peter Frampton? Or Mike Brewer from Wheeler Dealers? Find out soon as I kick off another big year. The new year is one of the hardest times to get motivated in your job. A lot of people slack off. They do a lot of skiving. They show up late, go home early, and in between they create the illusion of busy. You don't want to give me your name. You'd like to remain anonymous. That's okay. But you used to do some skiving when you were on a night shift.
Years ago working at Luton Airport, I used to sneak out to a woman's house.
Right, okay. So on the quiet, when you're supposed to be at work, you snuck off to someone's house. What for?
Maybe a cup of tea.
A
cup of tea, yes.
That's all it was, cup of tea.
Yeah, one night I was late back to work, so.
Oh, were you? Wow.
Yeah, I got a second cup. So.
Right, okay, right, yeah. Right, and you never actually got sprung?
A couple of colleagues knew.
Oh, right, but you never got... No, but work never said anything that, you know... So you're actually on the payroll, and you're actually on the job?
On the job, yes.
Disney's made a big mistake. Why did Rupert Murdoch sell 20th Century Fox, Inc. to Disney? The answer should be obvious, but the mainstream media seem confused by the sale and its timing and keep trotting out the line that it's got something to do with competing with Netflix and Amazon. If you haven't worked out why Murdoch sold, you're either inside the media bubble or so heavily influenced by it that you're living in blissful ignorance. Before I get to the real reason for the sale, let's just look at some of the other things the mainstream media failed to see coming. First, there's Brexit. That totally blindsided the media and still confuses them. Next, in this country, it's the selection of Jeremy Corbyn as the Labour Party leader. Labour are the opposition party. His level of support and Labour's improved performance at the last general election was missed in advance by the mainstream media. And then, of course, there's the election of Donald Trump. Did anyone in the mainstream media predict that? I mean, seriously predict it? And what about his ability to stay in power this long? Mainstream media are still astounded. If you want to go back a bit further, you could add the financial crash of 2008. They didn't see that coming. And in this country, the decline in popularity of British pubs, which is leading to hundreds of them closing every year. Now, the reason the mainstream media is out of touch is because they think everyone is like them. And we all do this. We all think that the people we hang out with represent most of the people in the country. Well, they don't. The people who run and work in mainstream media are well-paid, well-educated, and middle-class. The vast majority of voters and consumers are not. It was the low-paid working class that voted for Jeremy Corbyn, Brexit, and Trump. They're also the people that took out the subprime mortgages and the people who, in this country, buy most of their alcohol in supermarkets. They have the greatest effect on where we're heading because there are more of them. Rupert Murdoch has worked out something else about the low-paid working class. They're streaming and downloading movies and TV shows illegally without paying for them. There's a thing called a Kodi box. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a Android TV box, runs a program called Kodi. I heard about it from an old school friend in the north of England, in a working class town, and I heard about it more than a year before the mainstream media even mentioned it. I bet that most working class households in the UK have a Kodi box, which makes it easy to stream illegal content from the net. Murdoch has realized that illegal downloading and streaming is so widespread that it's impossible to stop. He's seen what it did to the music industry. So he's cashed in his chips and he's walked away from the table. Disney paid Murdoch $52.4 billion for 20th Century Fox. They'll never get a return on that investment. And if they've gambled the future of the company on it, look out, because soon Disney will just be a Mickey Mouse outfit. Talking about skiving stories, you got one, Ben.
Yeah, my dad used to skive. He used to work in a factory.
Yeah.
And they used to have like a tank of water up on the roof of the factory.
Yeah.
And in the summer, there'd be a few of them there, literally up the tank, just sit in the tank in the summer.
And was this drinking water?
Yeah.
Shocking. All right. Thank you very much, Ben.
Cheers, Graham.
Cheers.
All right.
I got called a Ramona by a caller to my radio show this week. A Ramona. It's all because I think Britain should stay a member of the EU. We should remain. And whenever I point this out, I'm Ramoning. When I got called a Ramona, I thought, was that it? Is that all you've got? Name calling. Instead of explaining to me just how these dinky little islands off the coast of Northern Europe would be better off without being part of an international organisation, which is the biggest tariff-free trade area in the world, and where more than half of the UK's top 10 trading partners in services are based, oh no, I get called names. Do you really think that's going to change my mind? This is all going on because human beings don't make decisions based on logic. They make decisions based on emotion. Think of a situation where you had bulletproof facts, reason, and logic on your side, but the other person dug in their heels and refused to budge. They weren't swayed by your logic. A few years ago, a neuroscientist, Antonio Damasio, made a groundbreaking discovery. He studied people with damage in the part of the brain where emotions are generated. He found that these people seemed normal, except that they weren't able to feel emotions. But they all had something peculiar in common. They couldn't make decisions. They could describe what they should be doing in logical terms, but they found it really difficult to make even simple decisions, such as what to eat. So at the point of decision, emotions are important for choosing. In voting booths during the Brexit referendum, emotions were running high. They still are. And that's why I get called names. Next time I get called a Ramona, I could hit back with a funny name for fans of Brexit, but really, where would that get us? The thing both sides are failing to see is that we have a massive amount of common ground here. We all want what's best for Britain. That logic seems to be lost. Is that because logic was the first casualty of Brexit? Pete, you're a skiver.
Yeah, when I was about 17, I was down in Dorset. My family live in Dorset, and we went out for the on a Sunday, and we got absolutely, a bit piddly, and I had a hangover, and I had to go back to London on the train because I worked in the city then, and I was still down in Dorset, in fact, in Weymouth, so I had to phone my boss up the next morning. But you remember the old coin, the old ching, 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 bong, you put the money in, ching, 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 bong. Well, because it was like a long distance, every sort of 30
seconds. Wait a second, what machine is this? This is the...
You know the old A and B, the old telephone boxes?
Oh, yeah.
So when I phoned him up, again in the city, I said, oh, I'm not very well. Ding, 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 blonk. I said, then, ding, 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 blonk. I said, yeah, I'm at home, because I lived in Stoke Newington then. Ding, 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 blonk. He said, where are you phoning from? Yeah, it's not, bing, 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 bing. I had to put a bucket full of money in, and of course I was in Weymouth in Dorset, and I should have been at work in London, when I got back to work.
And this is before mobile phones, so the only way you could call him is from a payphone.
You know, you're probably too young. The old A and B, press A, then press B.
Yeah, I remember him. Well, actually, I don't remember him from this country, but when I first went to New Zealand in the 80s, they still had him that way. Yeah, so yeah, I've used him,
And of course, he said, where was you? You went away for the weekend with the boys, didn't you? I went, yeah. I said, you were down in Dorset. I went, yeah, all right, he said. Anyway, I got away with it,
He sprung you. You came clean, and then that was it.
That was it.
Now, what a good boss.
He was all right. He said, in future, tell me straight. Don't lie. Yeah. I went, and I went with my cap in hand, walked off and got a cup of tea. You've got to remember that if you're a long distance in them days, it cost a bit more money.
Yeah, yeah, it was a lot of phone calls were a lot of money back then. It was called a trunk call, wasn't it, back then, even, yeah.
That's it, yeah, it was. Yeah. I was going to reverse the trunk, being a bit thick, I was going to reverse the charges.
No, it's a good joke. I don't think you would have got away with that. I think that would have been...
No, not at all.
Yeah. And really, he's right, you know. If you'd have said to him, look, boss, I'm really sorry, but we went out for a drink, and it's one thing led to another, you know, and I'm stuck in Weymouth, I'm really sorry. I think he would have just gone, he would have harumphed, but you would have been all right.
He would have.
It was because you tried to con him. It's always about the deceit, isn't it, that people get upset about.
Worry about it so much, do you?
Yeah, well, you think up until that point, you've managed to blag your way through school, through lying and cheating and telling teachers that the dog ate my homework and all that. You don't realise in real life that that's not going to... What got you there won't get you here, you know what I mean? It doesn't work in real life. In real life, you have to front up and you have to go, look, I messed up. And people usually, by and large, they can appreciate that because everybody's messed up. But it was a rite of passage into adulthood there, Pete, this experience.
Do you think so?
I think so, yeah. I think you're a better man because of it.
Well, I'll tell my wife that.
Local radio in Britain may have shot itself in the foot. Local commercial radio stations in this country used to have local names. There was Leicester Sound, Ram FM, Red Dragon, 2CR and GWR. But they've all been rebranded. A lot of them have become Heart or Capital. They take network programming out of London with local opt-outs, but they didn't keep their local name. Now, one of the biggest selling items at Christmas was smart speakers. These speakers connected to Wi-Fi. They listen to your voice commands and play whatever streaming audio you tell them to. If you want to listen to your local radio station, all you do is ask Google or Alexa. But what if your local station is now called Heart? Which one of the 21 stations called Heart in the UK will your smart speaker play? Or will it play a Christian music station from California called Heart? If you ask it to play Capital, you might hear one of the British Capital stations or Capital Radio in Sierra Leone. If smart speakers become the most popular way to listen to local radio, the best way for your virtual personal assistant to find them would be if all the local stations went back to using their old, unique names. That would be smart. Have you ever left something behind? Well, Travelodge, who own around 500 hotels in this country, have published a list of the stuff that people have left behind. And there's weird stuff on here, including a full-size canoe and a mother-in-law. What have you left behind, Bridget?
I went to the recycle bin with a bag of shoes before I went to Tesco's. put my purse on top of it, and then emptied all the shoes into the recycle bin.
And left your purse on top of the bin?
No, it was in the bag of shoes.
Oh, the purse ended up in the bag of shoes.
In the recycle bin.
Oh, no. All kinds of trouble. So did you have to dive in and did you do some dumpster diving?
Well, I got to Tesco's, realised my purse.
Yeah.
Went all the way back to the recycle bin, and for some very bizarre reason, the shoes had all gone in and my purse was sitting in the scoop.
Oh, someone had seen it and took it out, rescued it?
No, it just was inside the bin, in the bit that you tip.
Okay.
It hadn't actually fallen in the big bin.
So a happy ending.
Well, yeah, I'm still getting stressed.
Thanks a lot, Bridget. What have you left behind? Lynn's on the phone.
Well, it wasn't us. It was a friend of ours. They left their child in Clacton.
Oh, how did this happen? How did Lee? How old was the child?
About 5.
Right, and they're going
old enough to be able to tell the police where he lived.
Luckily. So, how many children did they have? A lot of children. And one of them was.
Well, they had parents. They had partners before each other.
Yes.
So they had in total 10 kids.
They had 10 kids with them. I'm sure if you've got 10,
yeah,
it's easy to mislay one.
They had kids from each partner, plus a couple of kids of their own.
And they bundled everybody up into the one vehicle? 10 kids?
Yeah.
Like a little minibus thing?
That's right.
And none of the other kids squealed and said, "Oi, where's Tony?" Nobody said anything?
Nobody said anything.
Oh, they obviously didn't like that.
And they didn't realise until... Pardon?
When did they realise?
When they got home and they got a phone call from Clacton Police.
They didn't even know. They got home and didn't know they'd left one behind.
Exactly.
Jeez.
And then they had to go all the way back again.
They went and pick up. Thank you very much, Lynn.
That's all right.
Stop.
No problem.
You've left behind. How's this bloke on a night out in Denmark? He has a lot to drink, so he hails a taxi and tells it to take him home. He lives in Norway. So the taxi driver drives across Denmark, then Sweden, and then drops him off at his house in Norway. He has to pay a taxi fare of around $2,000. What's the most expensive taxi ride you've ever done? Mick?
Me and my wife went out for a meal once over at Stansted Abbots, and I hired one of these cars from the hire company.
Yeah.
And when we got to the car wouldn't start. So we phoned up the AA, and they said they're going to be about 3 hours, and it's about 11:30 at night. So I said to Sharon, what we'll do is we'll go back, get a taxi back to Stevenage, pick up our car,
yeah,
wait for the AA, and then we can do it that way. So we got a taxi.
Yeah.
Stansted Abbots, 11:30 to Stevenage, and we'll be about a quarter of a mile from our house. And we got a phone call from the AA saying we're outside the car now. So I said to the taxi driver, you have to turn around and send us to take us back again.
And this wasn't even your car. You hired a nice car for the night, yeah?
Yep. The taxi cost me 60 quid.
Yes.
And we got there, and I forgot my foot on the clutch to start the car up.
That's what the problem was. You have to put your foot on the clutch for the ignition to start the car.
I haven't got one of them new cars, so I didn't know what to do. And I was trying everything. It wouldn't start.
So all up, you had the rental of the car, you had the 60 quid for the taxi, so you're really in the hole, and you didn't even get a night out of it.
Well, we're supposed to go to a hotel. We didn't get there till about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right, so needless to say, none of the other activity occurred either that you were planning.
No. It was a birthday as well, so you enjoyed
it. Yeah, oh, so instead Mr. Wiggly was on bread and water. Yeah.
Exactly that, yeah.
Oh, Mick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Graham.
Thank you. Let's check in with Julia.
I've been left behind.
By who?
By my dad.
How old were you?
I think I was about 12 or 13. So it was in a different time, a different age, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd gone and filled up with, I don't know, petrol probably, at Waters Garage, when Waters Garage used to be between St. Andrew Street and the dual carriageway.
Uh-huh.
And realised he hadn't got his wallet. So to assure the cashier that he would return, he left me there.
So you were collateral on the loan? Because the garage had in effect...
Not the loan.
The garage had loaned him the money to pay for the petrol, and you were the collateral. So I wonder what would have happened if he didn't come back.
Well, yeah, exactly. I'm not quite certain what would have happened. He was in very hot water with my mum, though.
Oh, he told her?
Well, because he rushed back home to get the wallet, and she's gone, "Where's Julia?"
Right, right.
Well, I've left her at the garage.
she's the deposit on the petrol. Yeah.
Correct.
Shocking. Shocking. He couldn't think of leaving his watch or anything else. He leaves the child.
He leaves the child, yeah.
Goodness
absolutely.
Me. Julia, thanks for sharing.
All right.
Now, have you grown up as a fully adjusted adult, or do you have abandonment issues?
Oh, I don't think I'm a fully adjusted adult, but right. I don't think that was the cause of any of the issues.
Okay, all right then. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, let's get to the top five guests of 2017 on London Calling. At number five, it's Glenn Matlock, the original bass player from the Sex Pistols. I was lucky enough to talk to him on the 40th anniversary of Anarchy in the UK, the song that he co-wrote. Their manager, of course, was Malcolm McLaren. So I asked him, how important was Malcolm to the band's success?
Well, he's very important, but, you know, he's gone now, you know. But he tried to make out he did everything. He didn't. He helped us, and we used him as much as he used us. He was certainly a mentor, and I think he tried to kind of use us to sort of vicariously sort of further his career in the entertainment field, shall we put it.
Yeah.
You know, he was his kind of clay. But all along, you know, Malcolm thought he was fooling us and we was making a horrible racket. He never knew that we was any good. And the only reason people like you called me up today to talk about it is because there was the content. There was a lot of substance there with it. And Malcolm never saw that. He really thought that he'd just created some kind of media exercise thing, you know, a bit like a louder version of the Bay City Rollers. It was some teeny bop band that was around at the time. So, I would say nobody would have heard of Sex Pistols if it wasn't for Malcolm, but nobody would have heard of Malcolm if it wasn't for the Sex Pistols. We had a symbiotic relationship.
And where did you rehearse?
Various places. Originally, there was a guy in a band called Wally Nightingale, and Steve Jones was the singer. This is really early on, even before it was called the Sex Pistols. But Wally's dad was an electrician, and he got a contract with Hammersmith Council to kind of go through this place that was called Hammersmith Studios, right by Hammersmith Bridge. And it was this massive, big complex. And we just got a set of keys cut. And we weren't supposed to rehearse there, but purportedly, they had this big screen up, and it was supposed to have been the best sound dubbing room in Europe, you know, where people would sing to the picture to do lip sync and stuff like that. It was our rehearsal room. But something happened, I won't go into it. Wally left the band and we had to split. And then we was in little rehearsal rooms. I do remember once we tried rehearsing out some rehearsal complex underneath the Roundhouse in Camden Town. And they was actually doing a Radio 3 or World service broadcast of some classical music piece. He's making so much noise. They're going, "Turn down, you're going out to Somalia on our classical thing." We're going, "No, we pay good money for it." Like that. And then we ended up with a place in Denmark Street, which was like England's Tin Pan Alley. And we found our own place there for a while, which was great because you could leave all the gear set up and get on with it and turn up every day and not have to set up all the gear up and have a little play and find out quite quickly if anybody's got a good idea for something or not. And it was then, that's when we kind of wrote most of what became Nevermind the Bollocks album.
Yeah. And you were living there at the time, weren't you, as well?
It was a dump, but it was a central dump.
Yeah. And Johnny Rotten's audition was actually in Malcolm's shop, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
How did that happen then?
Well, we was on the look. I mean, we would stop anybody in the street who had short hair and looked a bit different, because everybody, including the milkman and the bank manager, would have long hair, slightly long hair and flares. So it was relatively easy to see somebody who looked a bit different. We just had a word out amongst our chums to look for somebody, and I think it was Bernard Rhodes who spotted him, said, look out for this guy called John, and then he came in the store. I wasn't out of time. Malcolm saw him, and he invited him round, and we came round for a drink in the pub next door, and then we went back and opened up the shop, and he auditioned in front of the jukebox and sort of mimed along to, I think, 18 by Alice Cooper, which was a weird scenario.
Yeah.
For him, you know, but he fronted it out really quite well, and yeah, so he had something. But it's funny, when Bernard Rhodes said, oh, you got a singer, he said, yeah, and then we met him, I said, so look out for this bloke called John, and he said, yeah, this bloke's called John. He said, no, the other one, and the other John, who happened to be mates with Johnny Rotten, was John Beverly, who became Sid Vicious, and it was all kind of mixed up there.
Glenn Matlock at number 5. At number 4, it's former London car salesman Mike Brewer. I talked to him about his show on the Discovery Channel worldwide called Wheeler Dealers. And I also asked him about something that happened in 2010 when he made a show called Frontline Battle Machines. He went to a war zone. He went to Afghanistan.
I'm also a patriot, and I wanted to show what our armed forces have to face and what they go through. And as a UK citizen and a taxpayer, I wanted as money was going. So I was fed up with hearing stories on the headlines and newspapers about soldiers not having the right equipment on the front line. So I genuinely thought that's got to be rubbish. They must have the right equipment because I pay a lot of tax. So they must have the right equipment. So I absolutely truthfully, off my own back, I had a day doing nothing, so I walked up to the MOD building in Whitehall, London, and asked to speak to the press officer. They asked who I was, and I blagged it. I said, I'm Mike Brewer from Discovery, a big fan of my shows. So the guy came down and met me. We went in the building, and I said, I just want to ask you, you know, is it true? Do the troops not get supported on the front line? He said, absolutely not. It's a load of rubbish. And I said, well, prove it to me. I want to go out there and meet the troops. I want to do something to show my support, and I'll come back with a better news story for you for one of the newspapers. And ultimately that grew into what became a fantastic documentary series for Discovery Channel, Frontline Battle Machines, which embedded me on the front line for 3 months, where I nearly lost my life quite a few times. And it's one of the experiences in my life I would never change. You know, I was terrified, but I loved every single minute of doing it, being with those professional soldiers and seeing what they go through. And I see things that human beings should never see in their lives. Come back with an amazing documentary series that I'm incredibly proud of.
How hairy did it get then, Mike?
It got hairy enough that the pilot of the helicopter that I was travelling in got shot in the face whilst I was sat in the back of it with my cameraman. So, yeah, that's how hairy it got. And I'm sitting in front of somebody who'd lost his leg, screaming for his mother. I've got a dead guy sitting, you know, laying to the next to me. A guy got shot getting in the helicopter. I've got a round that was underneath my butt in the airframe. And there were 10 rounds that went through the cockpit of the helicopter. So if you're in a helicopter with 21 other souls on board, traveling at 220 miles an hour and hearing on the radio that you're about to be a smear on the desert floor because the pilot's been shot, it's pretty hairy.
Ready, clear off.
That's it, we're airborne, we're away. Minutes, absolute minutes, under a full firefight.
The Chinook's loading bay has indeed proved its worth by aiding quick loading and minimising the aircraft's time on the ground. It's time for the Merc team to deal with the casualties.
Everything worked fantastically. When these guys are under pressure, look at the professionalism, look at them just doing their job.
But we're still under fire.
Chip.
And the helicopter's been hit. And it's not just a helicopter that's taken a bullet. Our pilot's been shot too.
Hi chaps, just to let you know, it took a round through my front windscreen which came up and hit me on the head. Got a bit of a crack and a bleed there.
With the Chinook struggling to remain airborne, our co-pilot makes an emergency call back to Camp Bastion.
Mayday 2739, I'm off to the south. We've taken a round through the cockpit. I've also got some transmission problems.
Yeah, I think we've taken a round above me.
Not only has the pilot been hit, another bullet has severed a hydraulic pipe, and he's wrestling with the controls of 12 tons of helicopter travelling at 200 kilometres an hour.
Mayday, Tricky 73, contact.
That was one incident, and it very quickly got followed up by another incident where the Taliban chased me for 14 hours across the desert on a combat logistics patrol. And I nearly had a confrontation with an Afghan police officer at a checkpoint, which meant that pistols had to be drawn and we had to calm people down. So I had many incidents while I was out there. Some of them made it to screen, like the helicopter incident and the combat logistics patrol. But some of the other stuff that I see didn't make it to screen because it was just too hairy, and it's not stuff that should be shown to the audience.
And what did Michelle, your wife, think about all that, putting yourself in so much danger for your art?
Okay, well, Michelle has been the backbone of me, really. And Michelle gives me a full support. She packs my bag, sends me out the door with a kiss, and says, go do it. You know, if this is what you want to do, go do it. And Michelle was incredibly worried. We had to sit and make wills, and that was the first time we'd done that. And we really had to think seriously about, you know, what my funeral arrangements were and all of that kind of stuff, and what was to happen if I was to lose my legs on a landmine. And, you know, these are deep, meaningful conversations. But ultimately, Michelle stood, you know, shoulder to shoulder, and I couldn't have done it without her support. And she's incredibly proud that I went and done it. And it was a big moment in my life, particularly as I had a massive career making my car shows, you know, and Discovery Channel were putting their lead host in the world, literally on the front line in a war zone. But if I can't come back and tell that story from a normal guy's point of view, then the show wouldn't work. And that was the point of the program. I wanted to be the guy in the pub who could just tell the story of what was really happening on the front line. And that's exactly what we achieve. And thanks to Discovery, they let me go and do that.
At number three for Guest of the Year, it's Slim Jim Phantom, the drummer with the Stray Cats, a true rockabilly rebel who ended up getting to work with some of his heroes, including Jerry Lee Lewis. I said to him, well, Jerry Lee, the killer, he must have been a difficult bloke to get to know.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever been close to him. No, we worked together quite a bit on, you know, various things over the years. I've toured in his band a little while, did some recording with him, did like a classic TV show with him. Yeah, he was a character. I don't know if I've ever had a conversation with him or I don't know if I ever really hung out with him. I don't know if he does that with anyone.
Yeah.
But, you know, a couple times you get a look from him and it's like you know that you're doing the right thing.
Right.
You're on stage and he, you know, he would have the drums right behind the piano player, really close to him. And every now and again he'd give you that killer look.
Yeah.
You know, that you knew you were doing something right. And, you know, 1,000 words were spoken. So, And I speak to his family. I know his son, Lee, Jerry Lee III. He, you know, he and I are in touch, and he says, you know, Dad loves you, talks about you. So it's, you know, it's totally a part of my life that I'm can be proud of, that you got close to a guy like that, you know, musically.
Well, it completes the circle, doesn't it? Because you guys were inspired by the music from Son, and Jerry Lee, as his album said, he is the last man standing from the Million Dollar Quartet, and it just brings it all together. You know, I just think that's brilliant.
You can't, it's where you can't scratch. It's about the end. like a million bows. But you got the engine in the shop now. Come on, baby, you're gonna be mine. I gotta roll and I gotta rock now. And the shivers up and down my spine. Blues bop in my knees. Blues bop like a dog with wings. A goosebump like a goose wings. Get real gone when I get goosebumps.
Yeah, I always go back to, like, when I was 17 years old, walking to my drum lesson, and you would stop me at the crossroads and say, 40 years later, you're going to have played with Jerry Lee, toured with the Stones, lived in London, hung out with the rock royalty in London, and, like, been able to go. Still, I can go anywhere in London. I know London like the, you know, taxi driver, you know, to go, and I'm pretty much welcome everywhere, and sign this in blood. Will you take this life right now? Of course. Right. So,
yeah.
So that's what I, you know, wanted to. I always wanted to travel, and London's a very special place for me. I still go quite a lot, and we had a house there for quite a while. And you know, now I have a wealth of friends. I can either stay with Glenn in Maida Vale, or I can go stay with Pete Golding at Chelsea, or I can go stay with my friend Scottish Gary in Knightsbridge. I've got my kind of choice of the, you know, Tony areas in London that I can go and stay with one phone call. And of course, you take the deal.
At number two as guest of the year, the actor Dominic Monaghan, who played Merry the Hobbit in Lord of the Rings.
It was a wild ride, Lord of the Rings, and it was great and it was amazing. But we went to a pretty high plateau, and you know, you need to come down a little bit with a bump. And I think some of the bumps were interesting to take, and I self-medicated through them, you know. So I then eventually got my shit together and got back into the gym and stopped being so self-destructive. And it was almost immediate, really. I started then getting some pretty significant meetings, and people wanted to chat with me and find out what was going on. And it was at that point that I met J.J. Abrams, who was
Lost.
Yeah, who was putting together this TV show, Lost. And we did.
Well, where were you living at the time? Because you say you moved to LA. I mean, did you know someone there you could stay with?
I knew Elijah. I stayed with Elijah for a few weeks until I moved out. But then I was living at the bottom of my then manager's garden. She had a granny flat, which had no kitchen, no toilet, just had a bed and a TV.
So you had to go in the main house to go to the toilet.
Yeah. But what was she doing? She'd lock. The bathroom of the main house from the inside. So the only thing that I could access was the bathroom at nighttime. And I would, you know, be able to go to the bathroom at night, but nowhere else in the house. And, you know, just play PlayStation all night. You know, it got quite, there's some spooky moments, but I think that was just my mind. You know, I think that was just my mind playing tricks on me. There was definitely some spooky.
What do you mean, spooky? What weird stuff you couldn't understand, you couldn't explain?
Yeah. Well, I was doing a lot of drugs at the time. But, you know, there was a few times where there was a very distinct time where I was sat on my bed and someone was trying to get in to the thing, and I could see this figure, and I could see the door, like tick, 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 someone trying to mess around with the door. And I thought, I wasn't in the right mind to get up and tell them to leave or find out what was going on. And I wasn't sure what was real or not, you know, because I'd been up for a while, and you know, your mind tends to play tricks on you when you've not slept and you've been doing drugs and all that kind of stuff. But I think that was a wake up call. I think that was one of the last things that I needed to say. You know, well, this isn't going to be the story of your life. You know, you've got other things to do. So it was, I used it as a jumping off point, really. So I met JJ, and we didn't talk about the part at all in the first meeting. In the first meeting, we talked about English comedy. We got onto this Monty Python thing, Goons, Spike Milligan, Peter Sellers, Steve Coogan, who I was a huge fan of and still am. And we just talked about that. And at the end of the audition, I kind of like said, we should talk about the thing. And he said, well, we'll have you come back. We'll have you come back. And I thought, okay, good. So I left the audition, if you can call it that, and said to, called my agent. He said, how'd it go? I said, it went good, but we didn't talk about the role at once. We just talked about comedians. But then they called me back in again and sat down with JJ. And he said, look, this character's that we want you to play is like 50. And I was, you know, 26, 27. But he said, you know, we want to kind of explore it with you. And I said, you know, my way of making sense of that with him was there is something more captivating, I think, about a rock star that's had the merest taste of success and had it stolen away from him, as opposed to what they wanted, which was kind of a Robert Plant, Jimmy Page type character. There, he'd done that, and he was just like, ah, now I'm on a desert island. And we had agreed that there's something more tragic about a younger Charlie, you know.
Hiya. Do you want a blanket?
Oh, thanks, I got one.
Were you warming for two? Take mine.
Thank you.
So, first plane crash.
What gave it away?
Ah, you can always spot the newbies. We're gonna be okay, you know.
Are we?
We're alive. On a beautiful island. We sleep under the stars, and before you know it, the helicopters will come and take us all home.
You really think they'll find us?
Oh, yeah, why wouldn't they?
Thanks.
I'm Charlie.
I'm Claire. Nice to meet you, Charlie.
It's nice to meet you.
And did you tap into your experience of being on something as big as Lord of the Rings and then nothing? You know, was it that kind of thing, really? Were you in a similar place maybe at the time?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely understood what that meant, to have something taken away from you and for your dream to get compromised. You know, I think anytime humans dream, daydream, I mean, not necessarily night dream, but anytime we go off into that fantasy world, it tends to be perfect. You know, it's the perfect girl, it's the perfect job, it's the perfect scenario, and your dreams don't tend to get compromised. And I think it's an interesting thing for human beings to realize that dreams come at a price. You know, there's a price for everything in life, you know, the good and the bad. And I think Charlie had to learn that lesson, that there's a great quote, I think it's Maya Angelou, that says, you know, you can have anything that you want, you just can't have it all at the same time, you know. And I'd hung on to that for a while because I thought it was profound. And I think Charlie wanted to be a rock star, and he became a rock star, but it came at the price of his relationships with his brother, with women in his life, with his dance with the devil, with heroin, you know. So I think I knew that a little bit, but I also knew the frayed edge of life. You know, I knew, you know, falling asleep in an alleyway, and I knew, you know, hanging out with a girl whose name I didn't know, and I knew going for breakfast still drunk. You know, I knew those things, and I think Charlie knew them as well. And I think JJ probably saw that in me, that, you know, that I'd been there a little bit. So, I mean, it never really got that dark. I never got myself into any addiction type stuff. But when I had free time at that point, I just thought, well, let's do it, you know.
So many great guests in 2017, but only one of them can be guest of the year. And it is singer, songwriter, and producer Peter Frampton. Now, in 1976, Peter had the number one album in the world, the live album, Frampton Comes Alive. I asked him how he coped with that success.
Well, I think for the first, I allowed myself 3 weeks to be a big head, and then I came down to the ground very quickly and realized that I was not, I mean, maybe number two would have been good, but number one is in the world is a scary place to be. And very, very soon I realized that I enjoyed it immensely. I mean, we went around the world for a couple of years there, and as number one in just about every market we went to. And it was very, very exciting. I'd never experienced anything like it. I lost my anonymity completely. Felt like the boy in the bubble there for a while. So, yes, it was very scary, I have to say, at that point, knowing that I had to go back in the studio and follow up the biggest selling album of all time. At that point, for 2 years,
yeah.
It was the biggest selling album in America. I don't know in the world, but I know in America, the biggest selling album of all time. We'd broken the record of Carole King's Tapestry.
Yeah.
I think when I was told I was number one in the charts, and it sort of, like you said, it stayed there for the whole summer, that was one thing. But when I got the call that we were the biggest selling record of all time, that was, I think, the scary moment for me when I realized that I had a lot of work to do.
Is that when the drinking became a problem?
I think that it was the 70s. Everything was a problem. it wasn't just me, it was everybody. I was just part of the vibe of that time. And I think that's when I'd never been a daily drinker, but I became a binge artist, yes. And things that I'd not done before were now being done. So yes, it was a scary moment, and I definitely just went along with everybody else. And I'd been dead against, in humble pie, I never smoked pot or anything, you know.
Yeah.
Had a glass of wine now and again. But yes, I decided to reach out a little bit more for different things. Yeah.
Well, woke up this morning with a wine glass in my hand. Who's fine? What fine? Where the hell did I die? Must have been a dream. Where I'm being. Come on, let's do it again. You like
But you kept working and working really hard, and albums came out, and you were in that film with the Bee Gees, which I know the critics didn't like, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, but it's a bit of fun. I don't know why. Were you surprised with the reaction to that film?
Not really, because I realized very soon, before we even started making the movie, I didn't feel like we had a plan.
Okay.
For this movie. I mean, we were just all... Everyone was saying, well, with Beatles music, Aerosmith, Frampton, Bee Gees, Billy Preston, Earth, Wind and Fire, the George Burns, we can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You know, well, it's like I said before, if you don't have a good song, You know, you can use all the equipment in the studio you want, and you can tart it up, but you can't make a good song out of a sow's ear. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, if you don't have the basis of a great script, which we didn't.
Yeah.
We had, unfortunately, a great director, but he had not directed, he directed Car Wash.
Right.
Which was, you know, not what I would have called, I wouldn't have said, well, it was a success. Yes, it was a music film, but a musical film, but it wasn't the Beatles.
Yeah.
And I was reticent about doing it because it's kind of blasphemy in a way. And then I was taught to touch, unless you're going to do it like Joe Cocker.
Yeah.
Who took with a little help from my friends, to a whole other level and artistically, you know. There's certain things you have to do in order to do a Beatles number. But anyway, we just thought we couldn't fail at that point, I think.
Moving forward to the 80s, you toured with your old mate David Bowie, your old high school mate, on the Glass Spiders tour. Now, that was a really theatrical tour,
yes.
And you now were not the centre of attention.
Right.
How much of an adjustment was that for you?
Well, as I say on the acoustic tour, I dedicate a number to my parents and David in the same song because we were linked together. My dad was his art teacher for 3-4 years, and I got to know David through my father because I went to the school. And so we started jamming together when I was 12 and he was 15. On the Art Block stairs, my dad would hide our guitars in his office, and he suggested that. And we played music during lunch hour together.
Yeah.
And also with George Underwood, who did the cover for Ziggy Stardust, who was also in my dad's art class for 3-4 years, and he was David's best friend for life, and we're still in touch, obviously. And then Dave and I went and did our separate things, and then one day he changed from Davy Jones and the Nighttimers to David Bowie because of Davy Jones of the Monkees. And you know, then Dave Jones was now David Bowie, and he was supporting Humble Pie as our special guest. He had Space Oddity at number one, and we had Natural Born Boogie at number two. And we did a package tour called Changes 69 of England. So we were on the same stage, but never at the same time. For me, Dave knew me as the musician, the guitar player. And he saw what happened with the aftermath of the success of Comes Alive, me turning from this musician into this pin-up, this pop star now, front cover shirt off. He was frustrated for me and saw what I was going through, because it was horrible. I mean, it culminated in the realization when I, in 1979, I think I came out of a gig, was just running to the bus, and some guy said, "Oh, man, great show. But you know what? I never realized you played guitar."
Oh, what?
That was a horrible moment for me.
Yeah.
And a realization that something had gone terribly wrong. And David knew this. He was always looking after me along the way. And so when he called me up that in 86 and he said, I just heard your new record, Premonition album. And he said, I'd love you to come and do some of that for me. And I said, let me just think about that. Yes. So I said, finally. I said, it took you long enough to ask. So no. Anyway, so I go to Switzerland. We make the Never Let Me Down album. And while I was there one night, he asked me, would I come on the road as the guitar player? And I said, wait a minute, let me just think. Yes. And so he told me, oh, it's going to be this glass spider and it's going to be huge. And you'll make this great entrance on this plinth. You'll come in. He was explaining it all to me. And so anyway, what David did there was, my career had fizzled, basically. And not only has it fizzled, I was no longer regarded as a musician, but a failed pinup, I think. And self-deprecation is awful, isn't it? And what he actually did there was he invited me to be part of this extravaganza and took me round the world in stadiums. And then he wasn't happy enough with that. He took us around the world a second time in arenas. We did, so summer was stadiums, arena was winter, and reintroduced me as the guitar player. And I've never been able to thank him enough, and I still do, you know, to this very day. He gave me the gift of a lifetime.
So that's it. Guest of the year for 2017, Peter Frampton. I've got some great guests lined up for you in 2018. I hope you can join me on the next episode of London Calling. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on Apple Podcasts. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. If you put your phone number in the email, I might call you back. I might Skype you on the show. My email address, graham@macmedia.co.uk. And you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.